The head of the Nazi program, and Kuhl continues, the head of the Nazi program for the killing of the mentally handicapped, Karl Brandt, B-R-A-N-D-T, claimed before the court that the Nazi program for sterilization and elimination of, quote, life not worthy of living, unquote, was based on ideas and experiences in the United States. In his defense, he included several works that supported his claims, such as Grant's Passing of the Great Race, Alexis Carrel's Man the Unknown, and a study by Eric Ristow, which pointed out that Indiana's sterilization law dated back to 1907. By the way, Carrel is C-A-R-R-E-L. And we looked at his support for the Nazi euthanasia program in the original installment of this archive show. Continuing, American prosecutors at the Nuremberg doctor's trial were not entirely unsympathetic to these arguments. Nazi racial hygienists were not tried for the forced sterilization of more than 400,000 Germans on the basis of the law on preventing hereditarily ill progeny. One more time. American prosecutors at the Nuremberg doctor's trial, interrupting, remember now that Leon Jaworski was one of these prosecutors, beginning again, American prosecutors at the Nuremberg doctor's trial were not entirely unsympathetic to these arguments. Nazi racial hygienists were not tried for the forced sterilization of more than 400,000 Germans on the basis of the law on preventing hereditarily ill progeny. Recent scholarship has shown that a group of prosecutors tried to present the mass killing of handicapped people and the experiments in concentration camps as completely separate from, quote, genuine eugenics, unquote. They also attempted to show that American military authorities tried to recruit some of those accused of war crimes for military research. Of course, we've looked at the importation of Nazi spies and scientists in the U.S. national security establishment at great length in the past. Continuing, other German racial hygienists, who were either not directly involved in the mass killings or who were able to hide their involvement, also encountered problems due to their numerous links with National Socialism. Their contacts with American colleagues helped them reestablish their position in the international scientific community shortly after the collapse of Nazi Germany. So just as the connections between American industrialists and financiers and their counterparts in Germany and Italy helped to reestablish connections between the U.S. and fascist elements after World War II, helped to facilitate the importation of the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit, the importation of the Project Paperclip Nazi scientist, as well as the reestablishment of fascist elements in places like Italy, so too at an intellectual level, the connections between American eugenicists and their German counterparts, which served first of all to justify from a propagandistic standpoint the Nazi racial programs in the eyes of the world. It served to underlay those. It served as a foundation for those programs intellectually. It served also, they also served to justify those programs to the German people. The connections between the American eugenics community and its counterpart in Nazi Germany was used to achieve relatively soft treatment for many of those eugenicists at the 1946 Nuremberg doctor's trial. Again, one of the American prosecutors who exercised that judicial restraint was Leon Jaworski. Those contacts with the American scientific community also served to reestablish many of these German scientists in their positions in Germany and in the international intellectual community. After citing a number of examples of those who did, and skipping down, Kuhl writes as follows. The only person who could not find a new academic position was Hans F.K. Günther, G-U-umlaut N-T-H-E-R. Although the American Society for Human Genetics helped with the nomination of Günther as one of its foreign members, at least to reestablish his academic self-esteem, Günther never could get a new position as a professor in Germany. His thinking was too abstruse, and his theories were too discredited. This, however, did not prevent Günther from publishing more academic books, even if he sometimes used his pseudonyms, quote, Ludwig Winter, unquote, or Heinrich Ackermann, A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N-N, unquote. In the late 1950s, Günther found a new group of intellectuals with whom he could celebrate his, quote, Nordic, unquote, thoughts. The Northern League, established in 1958 by Roger Pearson. Of course, the Northern League of Roger Pearson, the beneficiary of the Pioneer Fund, something which extends forward from the Nazi period into the present, and something which the Northern League espouses racial views very similar to those that were favored by the Nazis. What we're going to do now is to jump to, well, we're going to jump back in history to the World War II period. In his very important, although in my opinion also very flawed book, Deep Politics and the JFK, Peter Dale Scott formalizes the concept of deep politics. It's not a new idea or a new concept of Peter Dale Scott. Indeed, it's something that I've been attempting to illustrate over the years at considerable time and expense to myself. What we're going to do now is we're going to take a look at some deep politics. And I want to stress that the examination that we're now undertaking is one which will raise more questions than it will answer. Yet at the same time, I think the circumstances demand that those questions be raised and demand that they be answered as best they can. What we're going to do now is we're going to take a look at an individual who has exerted a very profound influence on American history. That is a former Watergate special prosecutor, Leon Jaworski. This is an individual that we dealt with at considerable length in The Guns of November Part 3 and a June 1992 addendum to that. That deals with connecting links between the Watergate scandal and the assassination of President Kennedy. What we're going to look at now is some of the deep political history of Leon Jaworski. Specifically, we're going to jump back 10 years in time to an archive program recorded in 1984 dealing with Leon Jaworski's curious behavior with regard to the killing of Corporal Johann Kunz, a German POW who had turned against the Nazi regime in his mind. His anti-Nazi sentiments became known to his pro-Nazi colleagues because the American officers in charge of the POW camp in which Kuhn was interned were permitting the pro-Nazi POWs to screen the mail of their colleagues. That is, of course, completely illegal, and it made the American officers who were allowing that to happen complicit in the murder of Corporal Kunz. However, the murder of Corporal Kunz and the investigation, into the murder of Corporal Kunz never went in the direction of the American officers. That was due to the intervention of the American prosecutor in the case. That prosecutor was Leon Jaworski, who later on went on to become a prosecutor in the doctor's trial, the euthanasia trial of 1946. In fact, he wrote a book about that, about his role as a prosecutor. I have a copy of it. It's in storage. Perhaps I'll dig that out for a future broadcast. But what we're going to do now is to jump back in time to 1984, and we're going to listen to a short archive show recorded in 1984 about Leon Jaworski and the killing of Corporal Kunz. By the way, in addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who very ably assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
One looks back on Watergate, and one discovers people like Maurice Stans, Henry Kissinger, et al. Creeping back into the White House and creeping back into the Reagan administration, and all the other folks, all the other Nixon fixtures that came back under Reagan, and of course the covert core of Watergate, which has not been, basically has come back stronger than ever, as we've been detailing over the last 4 years or so, 5 years, I guess, since the Reagan regime began, the Reagan Reich. You know, it makes you wonder if you can ever go home again. It makes you wonder if the purge will ever happen. But until it does, we're going to keep pitching out here, and we hope you'll be with us.
Of course, one of the problems is that the Watergate was never really investigated fully, just like the Kennedy assassination and a lot of other investigations. And we're going to suggest part of the problem this evening.
The system works. That's what everybody used to say. The system works, and Watergate proves it. Right, okay, so...
In one sense, that could be said to be true.
Yeah, right. The system works, but whose system? That's the question. Well, speaking of systems, and while you think about the fact of George McGovern living on his miserable little ranch out in South Dakota while Richard Nixon flies around the world and advises Ronald Reagan on his presidential decisions and goes to China to be greeted by thousands of screaming Chinese people... While you're reflecting on these and whether or not the system works and whose system, we're going to talk about someone's system and how it worked, starting off with a very recent article, Thursday, September 12th, to be specific, from the San Jose Mercury News. The headline is Hitler's Last Soldier in U.S. Finally Surrenders. It's Dateline Los Angeles. It's an AP Wire story, and it goes as follows. World War II ended Wednesday for Sergeant Georg Gertner, of Field Marshal Erwin Rommel's Africa Corps, who surrendered in tears 40 years after fleeing a prisoner of war camp in New Mexico. By the way, let me just insert this before we get to the actual part of the article. Remember the way that they start this off, the melodramatic way this article starts about World War II finally ending for Georg Gertner, because as you will see in the article as we read it, it mentions how really tough it was for Georg the last 40 years as he fled World War II.
Yeah, the cordite isn't exactly caked on his Africa Corps ears here.
Indeed. Okay, going along. Georg Gertner, age 64, who lives near Denver under the name Dennis Wiles, spelled W-H-I-L-E-S, has written a book, quote, Hitler's Last Soldier in America, published Wednesday to coincide with his surrender to the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. He was the last of 2,000 escaped German prisoners of war to be recaptured in the United States. He has been married to a U.S. citizen for 21 years. Skipping down in the article, he said he escaped, meaning escaped back in 1945. He said he escaped because he knew Soviet troops had taken his hometown of Schweidnitz, and he feared he would be placed in a slave labor camp if sent back. He crept under a fence on September 21, 1945, and hopped a westbound freight train that took him to San Pedro. Ezel, who is an INS director, Ezel said the FBI and INS had forgotten about Gertner, whose file was closed in 1976, until his attorneys, Ronald T. Oldenburg of Hawaii and Michael John Biber of Los Angeles, contacted them and arranged the surrender. Skipping on down... Gertner joined the German army in 1940 at age 19 and was in Africa in April 1943 when Rommel's forces were overrun. His division was shipped to the United States, and in September 1945 he escaped from Camp Deming. He worked as a dishwasher, lumberjack, migrant farm worker, and ski instructor in California and adopted the name Dennis Wiles. He married in 1964 and opened a tennis club in Aptos, associating with such celebrities as Bjorn Borg, Lloyd Bridges, and Robert Stack, Biber said. In 1974, Gertner moved to Hawaii, working as an architectural consultant. Ironically, his wife became executive director of the Hawaii Refugee Resettlement Organization, dealing with thousands of refugees from Southeast Asia. Well, we're going to talk about some other things, more specifically dealing with the subject of prison camps, the United States prison camps, and the German soldiers therein interned. But again, one has to note not only the melodrama of his 40 years later that World War II ends for this man while he's an architectural consultant in Hawaii and palling around with Bjorn Borg and Dennis Stack and Robert Stack and all these folks and running a tennis club in Aptos. It is, of course, also interesting to note that his wife does become executive director of the Hawaii Refugee Resettlement Organization, dealing with, as the paper says, thousands of refugees from Southeast Asia. And, of course, no necessary connection between these things, but it is interesting that a large amount of the refugees from Southeast Asia are people displaced by the American war effort in Vietnam, and quite a few of them were people who felt they had to leave Southeast Asia because of their involvement with the Americans or with the government of Vietnam or the fallen government of Cambodia or Laos or something of that sort. So it's just interesting to note that as we pass.
Also worth noting that this fugitive from justice was running a tennis club in Aptos with such Hollywood celebrities as Robert Stack and Lloyd Bridges and people like Bjorn Borg. Then goes as an architectural consultant to Hawaii. Again, he was not exactly picking his teeth with a bayonet and dodging Spitfires at every turn. I mean, the lead paragraph there makes the whole thing sound just a little more intense than it was.
It's quite a bit different than those guys they talk about that they find out in, you know, Mindanao or Okinawa who've been hiding up in the bushes for 40 years eating rabbits. You know, it's not quite the same thing.
Any bushes he's been hiding behind might have a capital B, and if that sounds like we're stretching a point, the reason why we brought up that perhaps arcane-seeming article to some of you was that the rather lenient treatment that he's received, certainly he's done fairly well for himself for a fugitive from justice, and one of the things that we're asking ourselves here is whether his relatively decent fortunes were due to the fact that the effort to get him was less than enthusiastic. We bring that up because basically, returning once again to the closing years of World War II, which is a period we focus on so often, as we said a few minutes ago, the residual elements of the Third Reich, which were considered either more useful or more palatable than Hitler and some of his closest associates, were incorporated into not only the West German government after World War II, but also into our own intelligence system and defense department, as we looked at in our last Radio Free America broadcast, and in general were forged into just the sort of broad-based anti-Soviet alliance which elements on both sides of the Atlantic were looking to form during the closing years of World War II. Now, by way of building what at the time was considered to be an anti-communist bulwark across Europe, those Germans who were of pro-Hitler and consequently anti-communist sentiment were accorded relatively lenient treatment by the U.S. authorities as well as the British and elements of the French following World War II. Specifically, anti-Hitler POWs in the United States were allowed to, were not only discouraged from normal political expression, but specifically the pro-Hitler elements within the German prisoner of war camps in the United States, in other words, camps for German POWs, they were basically run by pro-Hitler elements. The American authorities allowed the Nazis to run these camps, and during the closing years of World War II, actually, those Germans who, or many Germans who expressed pro-Hitler sentiments were murdered and otherwise disciplined.
Anti-Hitler sentiments.
Expressed anti-Hitler sentiments, I mean, because the pro-Hitler forces were running these camps, at the discretion of the American forces. And in addition, as we're going to see here in just a second, many of the pro-Hitler Germans were allowed conjugal visits from their wives so that their children, being born in the United States, would be American citizens from birth. This, again, to be seen in the context of the importation of the Galen Organization and thousands of SS and Gestapo men, as well as the Project Paperclip scientists, both of which we've spoken about on programs in the past, our Radio Free America and Guns of November shows. Now, of the extraordinary treatment accorded German POWs in this country during the closing years of World War II, and again, seeing this against the background of the incorporation of the residual elements of Nazism into a broad-based coalition, immediately after World War II, we're going to take a look at a book called The Nazis Go Underground. We've looked at the book before. The book was authored by Kurt Reiss, R-I-E-S-S, and Reiss basically was an anti-fascist and espionage author who whose work was eclipsed during the McCarthy period. And of the, The Nazis Go Underground was published in hardcover by Doubleday and Duran and Company and copyrighted 1944, first printing March of 1944. So we're going to sort of climb in the time machine here and go back to 3 months before D-Day, 3 months before the Normandy invasion. Kurt Reiss writes in The Nazis Go Underground, "The United States, in an overgenerous interpretation of the Geneva Convention for Prisoners of War, has allowed these people to run their prison camps as a Nazi state within our country. They may hail Hitler, may refuse to have anything to do with non-Aryans, Jews or American Negroes, may arrange entertainments which mock the institutions and the leading personalities of the democracies, and they may even punish those of their own number who either have been always anti-Nazi or have come to doubt the value of the Hitler religion. This state of affairs would not be so bad if, after the war, these men and women could be deported to Germany. But there is little chance of this outwardly at least, since, outwardly at least, Germany will then become strictly anti-Nazi, and the men who will be running the German government will have to make a real show of their anti-Nazi conviction by putting all confirmed Nazis into a concentration camp. This gives the prisoners interned here the right to appeal against being sent back to Germany, and the United States, being a humane country, will probably let them stay. But many of these Nazis are not taking any chances. They are thorough. It is a fact, though it has never been published, that many of the internees find ways and means to meet their wives and have intercourse with them. The reason for this procedure, which incidentally is strictly against the law, is that a child may thus be produced, a child which, having been born on American soil, cannot be deprived of its American citizenship. And parents of such an American citizen are very difficult to deport. All of which means that we can be quite certain of having these dangerous enemy aliens, unquote, with us after the war. And that is what the coming Nazi underground is counting on. Now, we're going to take a look at specifically one of the aspects of the disturbing situation described by Kurt Ries in Nazis Go Underground, namely the manner in which the pro-Hitler elements in POW camps in the United States were allowed to discipline, punish, and at times murder those anti-Hitler elements that were discovered in their midst. In order to take a look at this, we're going to go back to another book published during World War II, during the closing months. This is The Plot Against the Peace, co-authored by Michael Sayers, S-A-Y-E-R-S, and Albert E. Kahn, K-A-H-N, published in hardcover by the Dial Press, copyright March of 1945, so 1 year later than the Nazis Go Underground. March of 44, now we're going to jump in the time machine and go ahead 1 year to about 3 months, 4 months actually, before the war ends in Europe. Describing now the FEMA, which were the secret underground murder gangs of the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr, which dispatched the real or potential enemies of Nazism prior to Hitler's ascent before World War II. Basically, FEMIC units were formed in the German POW camps in the United States and proceeded to weed out anti-Hitler or potential anti-Hitler elements within the prisoner of war camps in the United States, as just indicated in the passage Kurt Ries talked about. Now, specifically here, we're going to talk about how the Germans were able to weed out the political dissidents in their midst, the Nazis, that is, in American POW camps. Sayers and Kahn write in The Plot Against the Peace, in a section called The FEMA in America. In January of 1945, the United States War Department made public some of the facts concerning the reign of terror which German Army officers and Gestapo agents had instituted in German war prison camps in America. In 1943, within a few months after the thousands of German prisoners taken by the American Army in North Africa began streaming into the United States, the official War Department report disclosed that small groups of fanatical officers began to impose themselves as dominating factors on the German prison camp committees. In many camps, these men elected their own choices as camp spokesmen, unquote. Figureheads were chosen while the ringleaders remained in the background in order to conceal their identity from the American authorities. Propaganda was circulated that it was the duty of the prisoners to remain pure Germans, unquote, and to return to Germany after the war to carry out the work of the Nazi cause. All those suspected of anti-Nazism or distaste for German militarism were subject to intimidation and terror. Beatings of anti-Nazi prisoners were frequent. A series of violent deaths finally exposed the systematic character of this terrorism. The New York Times reported on January 16, 1945, that, quote, six murders and two forced suicides have occurred in German prisoner of war camps in the United States, and investigations by the War Department have indicated that in all but one of those eight cases, the victims were anti-Nazis who had been accused of treason by fellow prisoners. Some were charged with giving information to the American authorities, others with speaking or writing anti-Nazi views. Now, still later, Sayers and Kahn to go on to describe a specific murder of a German prisoner of war in the United States. At Camp Tonkawa, T-O-N-K-A-W-A, Oklahoma, on November 4th, 1943, the FEMA unit murdered Corporal Johann S. Kunz, K-U-N-Z-E, of Leipzig. Kunz was beaten to death. After the murder, a meeting was called in the mess hall. A German officer said that Kunz had been accused of high treason, unquote, in transmitting information to the American camp authorities. The German officer stated that the killing had been done in self-defense, unquote, and that it would be reported later to a German military court. Well, now note that Corporal Kunz was murdered because the Germans accused him of high treason by communicating information to American authorities. We're going to touch on the Kunz case here. We're obviously not going to have the time to go over all of it or even most of it. In a nutshell, Corporal Kunz was murdered by fellow inmates who accused him of communicating damaging information to the American authorities. Now, in the investigation of the Kunz case, it came across that the pro-Hitler officers, the pro-Hitler inmates in these POW camps, had learned about Kunz. Kunz basically was less than thrilled with Hitler. He was drafted into the German army at the age of 38, and in letters to his wife, expressed some things about the sad state of Hamburg during the war and the effects of Allied bombings on Hamburg, and also expressed, which he had been through apparently at some point with his unit, also expressed a desire perhaps to settle in the United States with his wife after the war, because specifically they wanted to get away from Germany and Nazism. So Kunz, because of the anti-Nazi views that were in some of the letters to his wife, was murdered by his fellow inmates. The subsequent investigation into the murder of Corporal Kunz centered on these letters and how the German inmates were able to get access to the letters and thus learn of Kunz's anti-Nazi sentiments. Of course, they accused him of communicating this information directly to the American authorities. And again, the information was gleaned from letters from Kunz to his wife, and the whole investigation about the killing of Corporal Kunz centered on where he got those letters. Now, ultimately, Five Germans who had been prisoners of war at the Tonkawa camp were executed for the murder of Corporal Kunz. Nobody else, just five former POWs. So remember the ultimate disposition of the case and the key piece of evidence being how the letters came into possession of the pro-Hitler inmates of the Tonkawa camp.
Okay, and this book we're going to be reading a short bit from is called The Killing of Corporal Kunz. Again, as Dave said, spelled K-U-N-Z-E.
And the research credit for this connection here, this book, goes to Mae Brussel, who turned us on to it.
Right. And the book is written by Wilma Parnell, P-A-R-N-E-L-L, with Robert Tabor. And it is published by Lyle Stewart, Incorporated, copyright 1981.
And Wilma Parnell, by the way, was the court reporter, the court stenographer, in the investigation of the murder of Corporal Kunz.
Okay. Now, they're talking about a man by the name of Rehberger being interrogated at this moment. Now, there's again, as Dave mentioned, that one of the subjects at hand is the most important subject is how did the Germans, who eventually wound up having Kunz killed, find out about these communications between himself and his wife? Okay, we'll explain some of these other things as we go along, too. So, again, reading from the killing of Corporal Kunz. It required a good deal more time, patience, and tears. But in the end, the unhappy prisoner, or medical soldier, as he preferred reluctantly admitted that, yes, Heisig, H-E-I-S-I-G, had told him about the notes and had said that they were obtained from Lieutenant Young. Okay, the notes they're referring to are the notes that that were used to implicate Kunz as far as the other Germans were concerned and led to his death. And this man, Rehberger, says that Heisig, who, as we will find out, is another German, had told him that the notes were obtained from a Lieutenant Young, Y-O-U-N-G, who is an American. It was discovered that Lieutenant Young was on leave. He would be back in a couple of days. Maffett, who's one of the investigators, sent for Feldwebel Karl Heisig. Heisig had penetrating dark eyes in an arresting manner that hinted at qualities beyond those of the ordinary Feldwebel. It was rumored at the time that the prisoner of war camps for enlisted men held a sprinkling of high-ranking Wehrmacht officers disguised as non-coms. And it crossed my mind, this is the author Wilma Parnell talking, and it crossed my mind that Heisig might well be one of them. Certainly he behaved as though he felt in complete command of his own interrogation. He admitted that he had given the, quote, spy notes to Hauptfeldwebel Beyer, B-E-Y-E-R, who's one of the guys eventually convicted. But he refused to say how or where he had obtained them. When Major Fuller appealed for his cooperation in the interest of a fair investigation, Heisig responded with equanimity, quote, sir, you can kill me. I will not say one word. I can understand how the boys felt. It's a crime to write things like that about one's country. Skipping down. You know where you got the note, but won't tell us? They're asking Heisig. Yes, sir. Would your telling implicate someone else? Yes, sir. Then in that case, someone innocent may suffer. Isn't that so? I can't help it. I would rather suffer myself. Heisig, are you a member of the Nazi Party? Yes, sir. The questioning dragged on. Heisig yielded nothing. Did you get this note from an American? I cannot answer. I found it. Where? Anywhere. Now look here, Heisig, if you got it from an American, you aren't betraying your homeland by telling us so. I am an honest man. I never betray anyone. Heisig was dismissed. He saluted smartly, his expression inscrutable, but I thought there was a flicker of amusement in his brown eyes as he turned to leave. He marched sedately from the hearing room with more assurance than any of us felt at that moment. Skipping on down. Heisig was brought back after lunch for another sparring match. Nothing had changed. He refused point-blank to identify the American lieutenant or anyone else as the source of the notes. Asked whether it would not have been natural for Rayberger to have inquired where Heisig had obtained the notes, Heisig calmly replied, "Yes, sir. Beyer asked me to, but I didn't tell."